not have a system in place where 100% of the people can help themselves to something 100% of the time. All that does is bankrupt the system that you're hoping will still be there when you come time to need it. So we have to be careful how we approach welfare with the state.
Now, we're helping people that need help, people who can't support themselves,
mm-hmm.
or are too old to support themselves, or are injured or sick, or unemployed. How would you decide, how would you formulate a policy that would get the money to the right people, get exactly the right amount of money to those people, and to know exactly when to pull them off that system when they could support
themselves? Well, you see, ideally the policy should be one of individual choice. You know, if you look back to 1967 here in Ontario, and I know a lot of people don't know this, but 82% of Ontarians had their own private health insurance. Each bought whatever they preferred or whatever deductibles they liked, everything to suit them personally. They would buy it on that basis. So the government proposed a plan, OHIP, assumably to cover the other 18% that weren't covered. But of course that wouldn't sell politically, because when it comes right down to it, we give a lot of lip service to helping those who can't help themselves. But when it comes down to the time we vote to help ourselves as individuals, and I don't think that's something that'll ever change. And that's why we always get universal social programs, so that everybody can get free medicine, which of course we know isn't free. We're in a situation now where we've got governments with deficits that just boggle the mind, with hospitals with deficits that just boggle the mind. And the question is not how are we going to keep getting the service we're used to now, how are we going to pay for the service that we've already used up? And these are very important questions. We've got to start thinking about insurance as being insurance and not a government-run scheme.
Let's look at some of the other areas where you might cut back on spending. What other kinds of programs do you think the government shouldn't be involved in?
Well, it's not always a matter of spending. Sometimes, you know, governments don't only take money from us, they take our freedom from us too. And that does affect how we can spend and when we can spend. Sunday shopping laws are a classic example. You see a situation where, in effect, in a certain segment of the retail market, 1/7 of that whole market is just made illegal to exist. And we believe that if these people were allowed on the basis of their own choice to open stores when they wish, consumers can go shop when they wish, you'd see a boom in the retail industry. And you'd see a lot more jobs created and a lot more people satisfied as a consequence of it. Sunday shopping doesn't hurt anyone. And you know, the belief that that's not so is just people want protection. Either the labor likes protection from other labor, and business likes protection from other business, so they always advocate laws to limit each person's access to the market. And that's really what Sunday closing laws are all about, is a fear of competition.
How do you feel about strikes? And I think Canada has the largest amount of days lost through the strikes in the world, or close to it.
Well, it's not surprising with the legislation we have in this country. You know, a lot of people think a strike is somehow a management employee thing. And that's a mistake to think that. That's a myth. Strike, when a person goes on strike, he's not really on strike against an employer. He's on strike against all those people out there in the labor market who are willing to do his job for the same conditions or less than he's willing to do them for. And that's why legislation has to exist in this country, to protect people like that. They've got that protection in place that protects them from their fellow citizens, from their fellow employees. So really, a lot of what we see as being called pro-labor movement is really very much anti-labor and pro-organized labor, which is really a political movement, not a labor movement at all.
Is this a healthy thing or an unhealthy thing in your eyes?
Politics is always unhealthy. Politics is the art of some people making the choices for other people for them. That's really what it's all about. And that's really what our whole election is about. We are the only party that suggests to the individual citizen that insofar as he responsibly exercises his own choices, they are his choices to make, and that no one else has a right by law to interfere with those choices. Every other party, regardless of which one you're talking, whether it's a major one or one of the other new ones, they all believe that they should be in the position of making our choices for us. And that's really what will always distinguish Freedom Party from the rest.
Well, let's look at the Freedom Party. It's a relatively new party. When was it formed?
1984, right here in London.
Okay, now that's as new, about as new as you can get.
Pretty much so, yeah.
And so it's new, fresh, young ideas, untainted by having to make political compromise. You've started out and you say the things. Now, what if the Freedom Party did get a large following? Would it become as vague as all the other very large parties? Is that
absolutely not. In fact, we are trying to avoid that type of following. The people who are attracted to us because of what we do. And we don't appeal to the majority rule instinct, or in that sense. We have a set of principles that this party's founded on that we protect very highly, and that no outside influence will be allowed to influence, because that's why we exist. We exist because we believe each individual has a right to their own life, to their own property, and to the pursuit of their own happiness. And that's the ideal that we are pursuing as a political party. So we really don't see that as becoming a problem. We are attracting the kind of people that are interested in that same ideal, and I'm just astounded at the growth that we've had, particularly in the last year.
Do you feel there's enough people who believe in the things that the Freedom Party stand for that you could win an election?
Not in the immediate future. Electability is an entirely different phenomenon than being an effective political organization, which I believe Freedom Party already is, and I think a lot of Londoners are aware of some of our campaigns here locally. But electability is a long-term process, because the voter really wants to know, particularly with a new party, whether you're going to be back the next election, or the next election, or the next election after that, before the vote that any such party gets really becomes meaningful. So all of our candidates are fully well aware that at best they'll expect to do 1-2% of the vote. It's got nothing to do with how good or how bad a party's ideas are. That has to do with the credibility factor, which is a long-term thing, and you only earn that by community activity, getting out there and demonstrating your principles in practice.
What kind of principles and practice have you demonstrated in the Freedom Party since 1984?
Possibly some of the most recent in the London area, I would suggest, was our free garbage pickup that we offered Londoners. It was a limited service. We pamphleted streets about 2 days before we do a garbage pickup for those streets. The schedule would be on the back, and we were actually trying to promote competition both in labor and in business. On the labor side, we believed in competition in labor, that other people should be allowed to do the job if they're willing to do it. And on the business side, we believe in competition via contracting out and giving the better company the job. So it kind of put us in the bad book of both labor and business interests.
Yeah, how to make friends and influence people.
That's right. Well, we don't like to, we don't believe so much that we're a party that likes to represent interests. We very much identify ourselves as a party that represents rights. And while it's true that interests in a society conflict, rights never do.
That's an interesting argument. Some situations, I can't think of any offhand right now, but I can see some situations where somebody's right to do something might infringe on, somebody's right to make noise might infringe on somebody's right to have peace and quiet.
Absolutely. And that very thing is the thing that makes it a right. A right can only exist insofar it is equally applied to all. The principle that your right to swing your arm ends where my nose begins mm-hmm. is very much a principle behind rights, individual rights. But in a civilized society, we extend that principle to include property rights. Because technically, your nose ends then where your property line ends. And that you have the right to determine within legal reason and insofar as you don't violate other people's rights, even if they're on your property, you have the right to determine how to use and dispose of that property. And of course, that right in itself is again determined on your neighbor's right to do the same. So obviously, rights are interconnected. Rights, individual rights, and freedom of choice, it's a social contract. And a lot of people think it means you can do whatever you want. It means quite the opposite. It means you can do whatever you want, and you respect the right of your neighbor to have that same privilege and right.
Mark Emery is quite well associated with the Freedom Party.
Oh yes, Mark's our action director.
Okay. I believe he's running in this election, too.
Yes, he is. He decided to give it a tryout in the Middlesex riding. And he's making some good inroads there and getting a lot of popular support that I think even surprised him. Because, again, with Freedom Party's message in the rural areas, We believe more in the self-sufficiency factor, and we don't like to see governments becoming, or rather farmers and the agricultural industry becoming as dependent on government as everyone else is, because they're going to be hurt just the same way as our health system and our education system and all the rest of it.
Now, I've noticed in his store that he also likes to push Ayn Rand books.
Oh, yes.
Proponents of libertarianism in general. Would you say that the Freedom Party is quite close in goals to the libertarian?
Not to the Libertarian Party, no. But to Ayn Rand's philosophy is very much what we try to practice. And in terms of philosophy, she led the way in this century to describe the process of individual rights, the nature of government, which is something a lot of people are really ignorant on. It's very fine to understand an issue you're involved with, but when you go to approach a government on it, you'd better understand how that government works and what principles it operates on and how it works in its own self-interest, just like everything else. Because quite often a well-meaning intention approach through government produces quite the opposite results that one expects. And these are many of the things that philosophers like Ayn Rand bring to our attention.
Now, if we read Ayn Rand's books, would we know exactly what directions you guys are heading in?
If it depends upon your interpretation of her books, and of course upon whether you agree with her philosophy or not.
The virtue of selfishness.
Yes,
for one.
Which she named that to get people's attention, when really she was preaching rational self-interest, as opposed to irrational selfishness. But she liked to use that term to get people's attentions and to get them to think about the fact that looking after yourself isn't something that's morally wrong. What our greatest social obligation is to look after ourselves so that we don't become a burden on our neighbors. And you see, our political philosophy that's prevailing in our society today is almost the worst. We have to look after our brother's keeper, which when translated through government becomes we become our brother's jailkeeper, really, because every benefit we give one group in society is something we have to take away from somebody else, whether it's their money or their freedom or their time or anything of that nature.
Now, do you see in this political life, do you see any legislation being passed or any changes being made in either local government or provincial government that the Freedom Party might have a hand in?
In terms of legislation being passed?
Legislation or just things happening?
Well, one of the things that we've been very effective in defeating, and this is an issue that most of the public would not be aware of, but much of the small business community might be. It's a freedom of association situation where many businessmen are finding themselves more or less conscripted into associations called business improvement areas, which are a pre-selected area by a government bureaucrat, and they're told that they have to pay a fourth level of taxes to this group, and supposedly the money...
So they don't have a choice, or do they?
Well, they have a choice insofar as they must, each individual businessman who doesn't want to become a member of the group has to collect a petition with at least two-thirds of the signatures of his arbitrarily defined area on that petition saying that they don't want to become a member of the group. Otherwise, you automatically are in the group.
That's a fairly large number of signatures to collect.
It certainly is. And in a situation like the BIA we tried to fight in downtown London unsuccessfully, myself and Mark Emery, this was before Freedom Party. We've learned a lot since then. But there were 890 businesses in that area. So that was a monumental task for any individual who didn't want to become a member of an association that he felt was operating against his own interests. But since Freedom Party, we've discovered that going the traditional route, or the route that the government sets out for you, is not the way to go. The way to solve every political issue is to go right to the people themselves, and that's what we do. We go in with our BIA campaigns, and we deliver information and literature to every affected area that has a BIA. And we have prevented the formation of many, many BIAs now in Ontario. And we even did something we thought was impossible. We played a very important role in disbanding two existing BIAs. So it's been a very successful campaign for us.
Is that, if these areas are, these things are ostensibly set up to improve business and make the downtown areas a prettier place to shop or whatever they want to do, how could you be proud of helping to
disband
them.
Well, the question is, how are they going about doing this? It's, you know, you cannot judge any government policy, program, political party, or anything by its intentions. You have to judge it by what it's doing. And forcing one businessman in an area to pay for the advertising of his competitors is not a just thing to do, even though it might bring people into the area. It's one thing if he wants to join with those people voluntarily and do that type of advertising, but when it's forced by a government edict, it's not a just way of going about doing something. We have found in our experience that the opposition rate to these business associations is 70 or 80%, almost virtually across the board, to give you some idea of how few people are controlling how many. And then the question you ask about the improvement part, well, the question they have to ask is, what's happening to their business taxes and their realty taxes that they're paying for those very things right now? So you see, the businessmen are caught both ways. It's that the fact is their money and their business and their realty taxes, like homeowners' taxes, are going to other political causes. And therefore, they're not being served. And when the government ceases to serve them, it just slaps another tax on, another level of bureaucracy. And that's how government responds to problems, by creating more. And that's one of the reasons we have to stop that trend.
Okay, let's look at some other areas. What other issues has the Freedom Party gotten involved in the last few years?
Well, we're involved in many issues. Censorship, of course, as you know, is we're probably the only party left anywhere in Canada that still believes in freedom of speech. In the pure sense, in the sense that we do not accept censorship at all. We believe that issues dealing with minors, such as child pornography, or issues dealing with non-consensual situations, are issues best left to criminal law, not to censorship laws, which is a social law. Censorship says you and I must not see. It doesn't say anything about who must and who cannot do. That's where the laws have to be drawn, because that's what makes a law objective.
So are you saying here that somebody shouldn't be punished for reading child pornography, but somebody should be punished for publishing child pornography?
Not precisely, because in the making of that child pornography, a crime was committed in that sense, because a child is not at the age of, and this is a significant word, the age of consent. We're always talking about consent. And when consent doesn't exist, the police have a right to confiscate something on that basis. To give you another example, if, for example, the police broke into an apartment and found a whole bunch of stolen, say, electronic equipment, stereos and televisions. Well, they have a right to take that property into their possession as evidence, stolen material, something that was used in the commission of a crime. But now, if this same situation was approached with the logic that we use in censorship, what we would do through censorship is we would make stereos and televisions illegal and let no one watch them. And that's the difference in the type of approach between the two laws. Censorship solves nothing for no one. It just makes us all a little more ignorant about what we're supposed to be afraid of.
Now, does that also go for things that incite violence, incite racial hatred, that sort of thing?
Regrettably, yes. In a free society, we have to be willing to take the risk to tolerate some extreme points of view. Never to tolerate violence itself. You know, the old argument is that if someone can entice us enough to make us react violently, then the answer to that question is obviously that's what we want to do as a public, as a democratic institution. All of us, if we all rise and react to this, then the government has to respond to us under any principles of democracy. So it's really a self-defeating argument to say that you cannot exercise your opinions and your point of view. And I must say that attempts to suppress things like hate literature do nothing but make that hate literature more popular, give it much more prominence than it is due or should be due, and actually lends credibility to the hate monger's point of view, because there's a real underlying principle behind that. The general rule is people who want to shut other ideas out are people who cannot defend their own. And when governments go around trying to shut up Jim Kiegstra and Ernst Zundel, they're admitting that they have no arguments better than the arguments that these two people are bringing forth to us. And a lot of people understand that, if not consciously, subconsciously. And then they misinterpret the message as meaning that people like this must have something of value to say, because otherwise the government wouldn't be so afraid of it. And I've seen this opinion very much expressed. And rather than cutting down on this type of bigotry and hatred, laws of this nature increase it. And it's precisely what happened in Nazi Germany before World War II. A lot of people don't realize the Nazi philosophy was on the underground. That's where it grew. It was not something tolerated by the state. And then the laws that the state put into place to suppress other philosophies of that nature suddenly became the very laws that the new people that took over the laws used to only promulgate their own point of view. And that's why censorship is always the greatest danger in society, regardless of what you want to censor. You cannot judge censorship by the nature of the material you're trying to censor.
Well, you said a mouthful there.
It's a complicated issue, and it reaches in many areas, and a lot of people misunderstand what censorship's about. They should also make it clear that censorship is only occurs when the government enacts it. It's not censorship when a newspaper refuses to print your letter to the editor. If you want your letter printed, you have the right to go to your own press, do your own distribution, and go through the same process a newspaper has to do. That's all part of freedom of speech and freedom of association, and that's how we distinguish one person's rights from another. So freedom, more than being something we should be afraid of in terms of other people's ideas and opinions, is something that protects us from them.
Well, let's talk about freedom of speech. I know Mark Emery's gotten his share of headlines over the years. Do you think the London press has in general been fair to the Freedom Party, balanced?
Very,
or do you want
very much
balanced
so.
Reporting?
Balanced reporting is a subjective term in any in any regard. And it's certainly something we're used to in the local press to see our comments taken out of context or things of that nature. But that happens to everybody. There's no way the press can do everything for everybody. And we have to recognize that. And from that point of view, I've got to say the press everywhere. And this election, I'm surprised, even in the Metro Toronto and provincially, we've been very generous to us. We're not a big party yet. We have no illusions about that. And so that the attention we're getting is very favorable and very generous. That's all I could really say. And it's up to people to decide for themselves what they think of Freedom Party.
Let's talk about the political process as well. Have you, because you're a small party or possibly not thought of as a serious party yet because you're not big enough, been excluded from anything or not invited to things because you weren't considered one of, say, the big three?
Well, that does happen, yes. And I know in our first election we often had to push our way in all candidates' debates because a lot of people didn't know we existed. This election, this time around, we know that the London Chamber of Commerce actually went out of their way to exclude us from their all candidates' debate. We found this a little inconsistent. The last election, we attended, all three of our London candidates attended all three of the Chamber of Commerce debates. And it's a regrettable thing, but we have to respect their right. It's their association. It's their Chamber of Commerce. And if they don't want to hear about free enterprise, and if they don't want to hear about the things that Freedom Party has to offer, let alone let their members know what other choices are out there, well, that's their choice. And I think their members will judge them on their decision. And personally, I always believe that if you leave things be and let people be judged on what they do, I think it always, justice wins in the end, one way or the other. And that's what I like to see in our society anyway.
Well, we have a few minutes left in the program. If we could mention what you think is the most important issue or couple of issues provincially right now that you're commenting on.
I know we don't have enough time left to really discuss it in detail, but certainly free trade is one of the big issues that even David Peterson has made a major issue this election. And we view free trade not so much of whether we're going to do it or not, it's a matter of when. And the sooner the better. It's regrettable that so many people view free trade in terms of fear, in terms of losing what they think they already have now. And they don't think of free trade in terms of the opportunity and the things they don't have now that they could have after free trade was instituted. And this is always the kind of blind reasoning that is used politically to feed on people's fear of something. I cannot see how any Canadian consumer can be hurt by the fact that they can get their goods cheaper through a free trade arrangement. Now, when I talk free trade, I don't mean just with the United States. I mean between our municipalities, between our provinces, between other countries. And that's what free trade is all about. Free trade means free from government. And any time a government's making a deal, you're not even talking about free trade. You're talking about a government deal. And it's regrettable that it'll be a while before people see that way. But that's one of our educational goals, is along with Freedom Party, between now and the next election, we're going to be organizing heavily, educating heavily, and getting involved in a number of community issues that we want to unearth what freedom is really all about and what this country was really founded on.
We've been talking today, and I thank him very much, with Robert Metz, who's president of the Freedom Party in Ontario. It started in London, Ontario in 1984. He's also running in London South in the election on September the 10th. If people want to get involved with Freedom Party, do you have a number they can call?
Sure do. It's area code 519-433-8612. We're in the phone book, too, if you have to look us up.
Okay, this has been the third in a series of interviews on the upcoming elections. If you'd like to be on this program and you're running for office, our number here is 453-2810. This is Straight Talk. I'm Bill Paul. We'll be talking with another candidate next time.